Welcome to the latest Water Closet Aquarium Gallery podcast, brought to you from the Kramer Studios in downtown Grand Rapids, Michigan. My name is Ben.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Charles.
And we have our special guest, Calder, on today because we are talking about fun stuff. How you doing, Calder?
I'm doing great.
Good. This, by the way, is the topic that whenever I would get a new fish book, I would turn right to those pages of the book to see where they are, to know what to avoid.
Yeah, this isn't the fun, glamorous side of fish keeping, is it?
No, no. This is. I think this would be the antithesis of fun and glamorous. This is unfun and gross.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you like problem solving.
That's true, which is why we like Calder.
I like solving an algae problem, not so much a fish are dying problem.
Yeah.
Speaking of solving problems...
Oh, we're going to solve problems with watercolors.shop. Is that the transition?
Exactly.
We actually have really expanded our selection online. So hopefully if you have a problem, we do have what you need to solve it there. We also have live plants that are grown in the shop and merch designed by Ben and myself. I've been adding a lot of merch on there too. So there's really fun stuff.
And lots of products. Like we can almost talk more about products than plants.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not going to because plants are way more fun.
Yeah, some of those fun electronics that are a little tougher to get. You know, we've got the Vortex on there. We've got the AI lights on there. You know, I can't promise we can give you the same service as Prime, but a lot of the times we have the same price because everybody does. So we do appreciate any of the orders that are coming through that site.
We had an exchange earlier today where Amy's like, we have hats now. Do you want one? And I was like, have you seen how big my head is?
They're so cool, though. I don't even wear hats. I want one.
They are cool hats, though. I like the tote bags, though.
Yeah.
Of course, the first person that looked at the hats that I met went, oh, it's the tab bags. Somebody's got to complain about anything. Yep. Yes, well, Drew, I just threw you under the bus. You know who you are.
I like a good trucker cap. I don't know.
It's called... My head won't sweat now.
Right.
Well, they call the other ones dad hats, and I didn't want to be lame. That's what they call baseball caps now.
Really?
Yeah. Dad hats.
Those basic canvas ones with the strap on the back?
Yeah, just like the regular old baseball cap. That felt offensive to me.
Huh. I'm a dad. I'm not offended by it.
No?
No, I am a little, actually, that it's that specific.
Better than dad jeans.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
What is this podcast becoming?
That's way more fun to talk about than what we're going to talk about.
We're stalling, actually.
No.
All right. Well, anyway, so, watercolors.shop. That's the end of the plug.
Yeah, there we go. So, of course, I had to do some prep for this talk. And let me just, you know, really what this is going to be the Calder show because Calder has quickly turned into our... Well, we could say problem-solving guy around here at Watercolors, or fish disease guy, but you wear so many hats that problem-solving is where you need to go.
Is one of your hats a Watercolors Aquarium Gallery hat?
And did you get it from watercolors.shop?
My hat's also very large.
That's why I was mistaken a lot.
That's right. I knew that about Charles. I mean, yeah. It makes sense, but...
You can't tell under all the hair.
Yeah.
So I decided, of course, to start with what does the internet think about fish diseases?
Oh, God.
Right? I know. And so what are some of the common signs of fish diseases? And the list was like, those aren't the signs of disease. Those are the signs of you don't take care of your aquarium.
Help, help, my fish has a swim bladder.
Right. Yeah, appearing disoriented, such as swimming upside down. That's one of the common signs of disease.
Upside down.
Have you ever said, oh, that fish must have disease X because it's swimming upside down?
I thought, did someone hit this fish?
Yeah. Yeah.
Leaving food uneaten. That's just because you live in the Midwest and overfeed your tank.
Yeah.
Or anywhere else in the world.
Leaving food uneaten. The ammonia is so high because of the uneaten food that your fish aren't eating it anymore.
And swimming upside down. Right. Okay, then the third one, white spots on fins or body. Okay, that's one of those symptoms we actually pay attention to.
And not all that specific.
Right.
No.
Discolored gills. Okay, again, you overfeed your tank, ammonia's built up, and now your gills are up. Yeah, troubled breathing. All of these things were not... actual diseases. We're going to actually talk about diseases. How do you get rid of fish diseases? Yeah. So look, I have this picture of this beautiful fish covered in anchor worms, which I have experienced anchor worms twice in my 30 plus years of fish keeping. If the illness is the result of infection, a multi-purpose antibiotic like Tetra Lifeguard is the first line of treatment.
Nope.
Antibiotics are not the shotgun for this.
And then a good practice of adding 1 tablespoon of aquarium salt will help prevent clamped fins.
Okay, so I want to pop in on that one because I have opinions on that.
Uh-huh.
I am so sick of salt being used as like a cure-all. It can help fish, but the way that people are prescribing it is not the way that it helps fish at all. So that means that everyone's using it wrong.
It is a very useful tool. Like, yes. Especially if you have fish that are sick or crashing, like salt might make it a little easier for them to stay alive, but it's not going to cure any disease from them, period.
Yeah, most of these ectoparasites, they kill the fish because they're mucus coat and all this other stuff that's keeping them properly osmoregulating, mm-hmm. that gets compromised. So they slowly die because they can no longer osmoregulate. If you change the osmotic pressure different so it's less so with their environment, you can buy yourself more time. So it is helpful. It's not curing them, though.
Right.
When I used to work at a chain store, like they had, you know, we just dump medications in at the end of the night kind of thing. But their shotgun to, oh, there's a disease that we can see in the tank, was to just put a cup of aquarium salt in the giant combined system.
One cup in the...
Yeah, like just fill like a cup with the, like with like rock salt and then pop it in that particular cube.
Right next to the carbon.
Yeah, pretty much, or in the same system as literally everything else they were using. Best thing about it was just that the mollies would just go in there to take a bath. Yeah. They would just hang out in the salt. But I don't think it was treating any disease. It did make us feel better because there's literally nothing else you can do in a giant conjoined system like that.
Also, a lot of those big stores don't actually sell medications that are effective for treating majority of fish disease. So, like, it's like you get salt and that's your option. So
salt and tea tree oil.
Yeah, because that does everything we want it to.
What was the one we got in? What was it? Violet extract that we tried?
Yes. The all natural ick remedy from Fritz. It was violet extract.
Yeah. What do you think of violet extract, Calder?
I don't think it works.
Yeah. No?
No.
It didn't for us.
Yeah. So with ick, like ick and a lot of like the ciliate parasites that we deal with, ick being one of them, is they have multiple life stages, and those multiple life stages, we can get the appearance that our treatment that maybe wasn't super effective worked because the ick goes away on the adult fish, but it doesn't go away anywhere else in the system because ick has multiple life stages and exists in your aquarium indefinitely until you kill it with something like copper, formalin, or metronidazole. So,
or starve it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get why people want to go for natural remedies, but like, think about it like in terms of like yourself, right? You're not feeling okay. That's when you go for a natural remedy. If like your skin started turning red and fuzzy, you'd probably go for real medication.
Yeah. And I think natural remedy too is a stretch because in what scenario do fish bathe in violet extract in the wild? Like it's
right.
It's just not a natural remedy. Like a more natural remedy would be increasing salt to 5 parts per million and increasing temperature would be a natural remedy. But like that's not what they're doing there. Yeah.
There was a natural remedy one of those snake oil remedies that you and I talked about earlier today.
I'll say it.
Yeah, say the name. Oh, yeah.
So API makes a lot of fun, not useful aquarium products that are sold as a medication. Mm-hmm. PimaFix and MelaFix being the main ones. So those are sold almost like universally amongst pet stores. Not here. It's just tea tree oil extract. They're also the exact same product. So PimaFix and MelaFix are the same chemical formulation. They're just selling them as two different solutions, which is, I think, a unique way of marketing.
It's brilliant.
They can sell two products that do the same thing to one person.
Yeah. Do nothing to one person.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So there are some scientific papers out there on tea tree oil and its effectiveness in commercial aquaculture with control of like marine ciliates and things like ick in commercial aquaculture. But those studies are we're taking these 150 tilapia and we're putting them in a 100-gallon vat and at a concentration that's unrealistic and giving them essentially a bath in PemaFix, which is not what we're doing in our aquariums. And if you do a method, and that's not how they advertise these being used as. They're advertising them as you dose 5 mls per 10 gallons in your aquarium and suddenly it'll get rid of ick, fungus, bacteria, and all of these things, like, magically. Like, it's just not a realistic goal of the medication.
What are the, like, do you know what concentration it is in those tilapia vats?
I don't. I'd have to pull up the paper. It's okay. There's fairly limited research into it. Like,
right. I've come across papers like these before. It's been a few years, but it's like absurd concentrations.
Yeah.
Like the kind that I read and went, oh,
it's like upwards of 300 parts per million.
Yeah.
Like it's like where that 50 parts per million you may be getting by dosing 5 mls and 10 gallons is not real. Actually, 5 mls, that'd be 5 parts per million for this stuff, and that's not what we have here. So
right.
Yep.
300, you said?
Yeah,
upwards to 5.
Yeah, upwards. Yeah.
Like a lot of things are toxic at that degree, like
carbon
dioxide.
Right.
Oxygen.
Oxygen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The weird thing is, like, it is such a marketing scheme.
Yeah.
Like half the time, like pretty much every medication that says beta on it is like tea tree oil.
Yeah.
And it's cheap. Like, I don't get why that's the one thing.
I think it because it's hard to kill fish with tea tree oil.
Yeah.
And I think that's the, like, if symptoms don't resolve and the med does nothing and the fish still dies at the end of the day, marketing teams can always chalk that up to like, hey, that was just a really severe strain of ick.
It was just too far gone.
Whereas if you dose the medication and then the next day all the fish are dead, you're going to blame the medication, not necessarily the disease. So
yeah.
I think that's why it's the snake oil. There
is that confirmation bias, too, of, like, when you get a beta home, it's going to act better within that first week, no matter what you do, if you're putting it in a proper setup.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like Arm & Hammer baking soda in a refrigerator. Right? Like, so there's absolutely zero scientific basis for Arm & Hammer baking soda absorbing anything in a refrigerator.
Really? Right? I've never heard
that. It doesn't do anything.
Wow.
Right? But people believed it so much, and Arm & Hammer just said, don't tell anyone. That doesn't do anything, right?
Sure, we'll make a package that you can put in the fridge.
They even made a package that has like a screen on it.
Yeah.
Right? So you can get even more exposure. But it doesn't do anything. But the perception is that it does something. And tea tree oil has always had this like mythical quality to it.
It's like catalpa leaves too. That's another one that's like gets sold as if you put catalpa leaves in with your betta, it will never get sick. And
yeah, that one's really weird because there is like some basis in reality for that one because it does stimulate like mucus growth.
Yeah.
So like it does increase the layer protection, but that's really the extent of it. And people have taken that and run with it and are like exaggerate it to a degree where it's like it'll fix all. I'm like, no, it makes their mucus coat thicker. So like they hit it real big with fighter placots because their scales will also get thicker if their mucus coat is thicker for long enough.
Mm-hmm.
But it also can lower the pH enough if you use enough of it to get it below 6.
Yep.
If you
can use them to make your tank dark, dark brown, then they're going to work.
Right.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
It's crazy.
What else is snake oil?
I mean, we touched on aquarium salt. Malachite green in most aquariums is not, it's effective, but it's probably not safe to use for most people.
So what is it supposed to do? What does it actually do? And who is it harmful to?
So it's harmful to us and to waterways. Like we shouldn't be dealing, like it's a synthetic dye. That's the reason you don't see meth blue used as much anymore as well. And they are really effective at killing the torite stage of ciliate. So like the stage in between hatching out of a ick, like icks has like three primary life stage. So you have the feeder adult stage, which is the one you see on your fish. You've got The tourist stage, which is in between, and it's like
the little one swimming around,
little guy, yeah. And then you've got the cysts that hang out in the substrate, and it's really good at killing that intermediate stage and preventing. So if you treat it long enough, it'll stop the population because none of those cysts will be able to hatch and produce. So after 30 days of use, in theory, you'll see no more ick.
Okay.
That being said, they're way more effective medications, and they're way safer. It's not really useful, but it's really cheap to produce, which is why you see it everywhere and why you see ICX push so hard and products like it. They are effective. We have better medications now. Okay. Yeah.
What's the dye that's paired with formalin a lot? Is that
malachite green?
Yeah.
Malachite green. Okay. So there is a methodology to that specific combo.
Yes.
And that's because there is actually some evidence in the literature that malachite green will reduce the toxicity of formalin to teleost fish. Not a lot, but enough for something with like formalin that's pretty potent to be worthwhile to consider having. But that's the trade-off. It's like, it's malachite green. It has all this other baggage along with it. How much benefit are you getting out of it? I personally don't know, but that's something to think about.
Yeah.
I think combo meds in general, unless you really know what the combination is, are probably a good thing to avoid.
Yeah.
Like the shotgun approach, where it's either not going to be heavy hitting enough with any of the medications to do anything, or it's going to be so dramatically strong that it's going to kill your fish.
Yeah.
Those ones are the ones that concern me. Like the tetra one that you mentioned earlier.
Right.
Which I looked up and actually didn't recognize what any of the active ingredients were.
What were they?
1-chloro-2-2-5-5. I don't know what that means. Tetramethyl and imidazolidinone.
So I believe the tetramethyl is the active, like the primary active ingredient, like the one that's actually doing things. I think the other two are just dyes.
Interesting.
Yeah. So not like, and when I'm using the term dyes are actually really effective at controlling microbes. Like potassium permanganate would be considered a dye, and that's a really effective oxidative tool to killing things on like velvet. It's not a tool most people should use, but if you had like a large pond where you had a severe infection, and that's a really reasonable way of treating something like that, it will kill a lot of other things, but it will kill the parasites and not kill your fish. So,
well, this medication pretty much claims to treat everything. It says treating fungus, ick, red streaks, milky or shedding slime, flukes, bacterial gill disease, mouth and fin rot, clamped or torn fins, and ulcers.
This is sounding a lot like I was recently shown, I'm not going to name the name of the brand, but I was shown a particular crystal product shown on this website, and I was impressed with the claims being made by a rock.
Yeah.
Oh, right. That this rock can save things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, what are the big diseases that we really have to worry about?
So the primary ones we see in freshwater systems are going to be freshwater ick, which is different than marine ick. It's just something to keep in mind. Velvet, which is also different in both fresh and salt water. Hexemia, which is a flagellant internal parasite, and then bacterial and fungal infections generally also are common in freshwater fish. Bacterial and fungal infections are really easy to treat, but in general, bacterial and fungal infections are a secondary byproduct of like things like poor care or another infection. So,
in most cases, bacterial and fungal infections are usually, at least in my experience, a combination of poor water quality and an injury to the skin.
Yeah.
That's a point that I think we need to really drive home during this podcast is, and actually it's a multifaceted point, right? But if you are regularly having to deal with disease, it means you're buying your fish from terrible places or not keeping up on water quality.
Yeah.
If you have to deal with it regularly. I started out this podcast by talking about how I always avoided that part of the book. And it was because I didn't need that part of the book very often. right? Because I had good water quality, mm-hmm. and I didn't overfeed my fish. So I'm going to keep driving that point home a little bit. We're going to talk about those big three diseases and go into how to treat them. But, you know, the amount of times that we have somebody coming in the store saying, look, my betta has bloat. I need medications for it. No, your betta does not have bloat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe it does have bloat, but bloat is a really general term. It, your betta does not have a disease. It has a condition.
Dropsy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the result of you need to put a heater on your tank. Like, or 9 times out of 10.
Or better nutrition, yeah. or...
Do a couple yeah, water changes.
Or do water changes.
Well, it's shocking how many systems that have been standing for a long time have ick in them. To the point where a lot of, like... hobbyists that have been doing this for a long time believe that ick is caused by poor water quality because they take care of their tanks so well you don't see those cysts on the outside, but when they slack a little bit, then they do.
When I was doing my whole Google search on, you know, what does the internet think happens with fish diseases, one of it came up. You know, you get the little clicks, the like 5-point clicks that are kind of related.
Yeah. Right?
And one of it was, what is the main cause of ick in aquariums? And the answer, usually related to a drop in temperature, which is just absolutely silly. That's yeah. like saying, what was the main cause of COVID?
Global yeah. warming.
Why did I get a tick? Because it's warm outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. I was traipsing through the woods, but... Yeah.
You got exposed to it. There's a drop in temperature and there's no ick in the tank. You're not going to get ick.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to drive that point home. I'm going to keep interrupting Calder while he's trying to tell us what the real point is here.
That's a really important thing, too, because it is such a misconception. Because I have a customer who's fairly regular, and he does full quarantine on all of his fish, and he's done it for about 15 years. And I was having a conversation with him about powdered blue tangs, which is not a freshwater fish.
Yeah.
But he heard they were prone to ick, and he does all this effort, and he's like, well, if I buy this fish and I get it through quarantine, and he does everything that you would do to prevent ick from getting into a tank, so like there's no way ick is getting into his tank this way, he still believed that it could still get ick after his aquarium just because of the stress alone of movement. And like, that's somebody who's done a lot of research on the medications, how to use these medications to treat ick, and just has missed that point because it's such common hobby knowledge that mm-hmm. ick is as a result of stress. And it's maybe true that a stressed fish will get ick if you have ick in the system. But if you don't have ick in the system to begin with, you will not have ick.
Stress causes colds too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
It is very, very possible, in fact, probable, to have an aquarium that is ick free if you take the right steps.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. The pervasive attitude, even among hardcore hobbyists, is, you know, ick is probably in just about every tank.
It doesn't have to be inevitable.
It doesn't have to be, right?
Like, I definitely, like, all of my tanks at home definitely run ick-free. And yeah. it's been a lot of work to do that, yeah. but they all run ick-free. And any person who buys a fish here through our quarantine process should be getting a fish that's ick-free. If we do our jobs correctly here.
Yep. It should be mathematically impossible that
exactly.
they have
like
ick.
The likelihood is so slim. So.
Well, and Amy brought up the stress point, right? And
yeah.
That is such a great example. And the reason that people think powdered blue tangs are prone to ick.
Yeah.
They are prone to being stressed out easily.
Yes.
And that will reduce their immune response and make it more likely that they will get infected by ick first. That's much different than saying they're prone to ick,
mm-hmm.
right? So, okay, so the big three you just talked about.
Yes.
Right? Ick, velvet, hexamida.
Yeah. So ick, it's fairly easy to treat, fairly straightforward.
So diagnosis,
you see white spots on your fish, or you're buying a fish from a place that doesn't quarantine. Ick is that common and that widespread.
Yeah. Ick is a really weird parasite because most parasites are pretty specific, but ick is really strange. Like, even the literature, like primary literature on ick, has this acknowledgement of like, yeah, it's weird. It seems to be able to infect every Teleos fish that mm-hmm. mankind keeps in care.
Yeah.
Like it's a problem with every species of fish that humanity keeps yep. in tanks. That's weird.
That's really yeah. widespread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So basics for treating it are fairly simple. Either metronidazole, 3 treatments of metronidazole should be effective for treating it. That's a really common med. It's even so common you can get medications with metronidazole in big box stores. I really like the C-Chem Metroflex because you can bind it with food. It works and it's really effective. But like API's General Cure is praziquantel and metronidazole. And praziquantel is very effective, especially at deworming fish. And metronidazole is helpful for everything else. If you're a ciliate, metronidazole will probably kill you. other options would be formalin. Formalin is not a medication I would use at a home level, but it's effective.
That's a medication I'm very scared to recommend to hobbyists. I typically go with Paragard.
Yeah.
Because it's a formalin substitute, and it seems to be safer.
Yes.
At least for humans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Formalin is also just not even allowed everywhere because it's so dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really effective, but yeah, that's about all it's got going for it.
But like that combination of metronidazole and Paragard is easy on you and easy on fish.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I can't trust like metronidazole is the most effective measure for controlling ick. So
it'll also treat any secondary infections from the,
will that get it out of the tank, though?
Yeah.
It will?
Yep.
Okay.
I wouldn't... So, it's, in theory, according to... There's very few papers on actually if it's effective against cysts themselves. There is hobby evidence that it's effective at fully removing it from a tank. I still... The research is fairly limited even into ick because... Most of the research we have for treating fish is in aquaculture as food fish. So ick still affects things like tilapia. So we do see it used, and metronidazole is studied in tilapia. That being said, if those systems sit follow, they drain them and they rinse them between treatments. So they don't deal with cysts. That's just not a thing. They deal with it on the fish themselves and the torrents into the tank. So if it is true, I would still go through the precaution of running a tank follow if you had to introduce a tank to ick. So that's the other big caveat with treating things like ick is we want to set up a quarantine tank if you have fish with ick because you need that tank to go follow if you really want to remove cysts and you want to be confident they're not there.
Tank has to be empty for what, 6 weeks to be sure?
21 days should complete the life cycle of the cysts at 80 degrees. At 80 degrees.
Okay.
Yeah, there above 80 critical degrees. Detail. Yep.
So when he's saying fallow, what that means is there are no teleost fish in the tank for the entire period of time. And if you miss one, you didn't accomplish anything.
Yep.
The ick parasite is very capable of hopping onto that fish, getting the nutrition that it needs, and even if you never see a symptom on that fish, dropping the cysts, fish looks like it's completely fine, but it still keeps that life cycle going. And that's why you hear stories about, I've never had ick, and then all of a sudden spring or winter came and my temperature in my tank dropped 5 degrees. I never had ick before that, and all of a sudden ick showed up. Well, the ick was there. You had healthy, unstressed fish that were able to fight it off, but not remove the parasite.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to harp on a detail that you, I'm not sure you did intentionally. You said teleost fish.
Yeah.
Teleost fish. So like when people are like, what about my snails? Teleost fish.
Teleost fish.
No, your snails cannot carry ick. Your inverts cannot carry ick. That is not, that drives me absolutely up the wall. I cannot tell you how many conversations I've had that like someone will not believe me. And I'm like, no, I don't care what the internet says. These parasites are, like I just talked about how ick is weird because it's generalist to all teleost fish apparently. But parasites are very specific.
Yeah.
They don't infect every living thing in the world. They infect a specific thing. If it's not that thing, it cannot be a carrier for that thing.
The one situation, and it's probably happened, right? That if you buy a snail from a store that has an ick infestation.
It would have to be really bad.
Yes. And those cysts happen to land on the snail. And you bring the snail home and put it in your tank.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. You can infect your tank that
But in the same way, anything likely, could, like yeah. hands or nets or rocks or wood or plants.
In laboratory settings with ick, there's this, it's called the 6-foot rule. Anything within 6 feet of the infected thing is theoretically capable, highly unlikely, but theoretically capable of an aerosol droplet of water with a cyst making it into the other tank.
There we go.
Yeah, there's not a lot of cysts in the water column, but you better believe I'm not putting water from another tank in mine.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Are cysts adhesive?
Not really.
Okay.
They kind of just float around. If they were... Being adhesive would kind of be a disadvantage to them. Like, they might get stuck in, like, a biofilm, but, like, if your goal is to infect fish, you want to be moving, so, like, you don't want to just sit there. Yeah.
So, actually, you just kind of inadvertently said the other method that you could infect, if you've got trophons swimming around in the ick-infected tank, and you take the water from that tank and just dump it into your tank with your whatever you just bought, that can be a way of possibly cross-contaminating.
Yeah.
But if you, it's not going to happen.
No,
it's not going to happen. That's not how ick is introduced to your aquarium, because you bought an infected fish or you put an infected fish into your aquarium. That's it.
Yeah.
Ick. I think they covered it.
There's one other thing I have read online. There's a lot of advice recommending like hydrogen peroxide dosing. And
people just really want to put hydrogen peroxide in their tanks for some reason.
There is evidence that there's some scenarios where it's really helpful for. Those scenarios are slim. But
I heard if you take a shot of vodka, your reef tank does better too. So
yeah,
it looks better.
And you also see like people recommending things like potassium permanganate. And that's important that we don't use those for things like ick, because ick does get below the slime coat. And if you're using an oxidative medication, you're hurting your fish too. You're burning your fish, just like ammonia would. So don't do that, please.
I'm not sure if we really touched on temperature enough.
Yeah.
What does heat do for ick? Does it treat it?
Speeds it up. That's all it does.
So first it makes it worse, but if you're treating with medications, it makes it better.
Yeah.
Makes the medication, it brings the ick to the life cycle the medication is most effective against quicker.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. So I have actually a comment on this. So remember, this is probably like 20 episodes ago, so this is a genuine, hey, do you remember when I speculated in
I don't remember episode
about how I think it was our Blackwater episode. I speculated that fish might be smart enough to self-medicate by moving into environments with different temperatures, different pHs, different salinities. As of 3 days ago, I found a paper that proves...
Yeah?
I shouldn't say proves. Shows really strong evidence that zebrafish are capable of being aware of temperature and pH in order to self-medicate in the wild.
That's pretty cool.
That's
so isn't that just a little bit like, I don't feel good. I want to cozy up under
a
blanket. Yeah, exactly.
I don't feel good. I want to find some warmer water.
Yeah, people take research like that to mean like these fish are like, I can sense that I have this particular parasite and I'm going to go and treat myself with this. It's like, no, this is comfy. I feel bad. I feel good now.
But that doesn't detract it from
me. No, it's still amazing.
Because it's not like, this is going to sound so conceited. It's not like humans where we have created a home environment where we can change things on a whim. They have to go out of their way to find these different environments.
Right.
But they're smart enough to, like, I don't think they need to kind of like be like, oh, I'm sick, I'll get better. They just need to know that they'll be more comfortable in this environment, but they need to be smart enough to be able to find it.
Yeah.
True.
And I'm like, that's really intriguing to me.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Velvet.
Yeah.
It's copper. Like ick, but
copper.
More like powdered sugar than salt.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a cilia, right?
It is. It's way scarier though than ick if you see it in your tank. Yeah. It's spooky.
Yeah, velvet is one of those ones that's spooky because by the time you see it, it's probably too late.
I know with marine velvet, the scenario is if you see an infected fish with velvet in your saltwater tank, that fish is dead. Like, give up on that fish, but treat it to save the rest of them, right? Is it the same with freshwater?
It's pretty accurate, yeah. Especially if it's something small like a tetra, it's at that point you're just...
Right.
There is one exception that I want to bring up, only because, hey, so I'm a betta guy.
Yeah.
Bettas seem to be the one case where, like, gosh darn, those things want to live. Like, there's a lot of talk about, like, it's not easy to treat and it doesn't always work. But among the fish that I've seen, bettas do seem to rebound from it better than most things.
Much better.
Yeah.
You'll definitely see a betta that looks like it's covered with snow still trying to eat.
Yeah.
It's true.
And
accurate.
Yeah. As far as treatment for copper sulfate is probably the most effective, also the easiest to administer, which is really hard to say when we're saying copper, because copper is already difficult to get dosage correctly, but it will effectively kill it.
I mean, copper sulfate isn't as wild as it is in saltwater, because like, it's an ion in an ionic environment in saltwater, so it's very reactive, whereas in freshwater, yes, there are ions. Yes, we have hard water, but it's not salt water.
No,
but it's still something that you want to remove the fish from. You want to go
set up a corn. Yeah,
and every invertebrate in this case, don't put copper into your tank without taking out your inverts.
They'll all die.
Yeah,
and plants.
Yeah,
yeah. So yeah, you a separate hospital tank.
Yep.
Treat that with copper.
Yeah, I want to raise my hand and I want to go back to a detail we said. Amy said remove all inverts. Marine. Freshwater velvet is so virulent. We have to use a medication that can kill all inverts.
Right.
Yeah.
I really want you to understand how serious velvet is.
But really, it's you don't remove the inverts, you remove the fish.
Yep.
Right.
You treat them in a separate tank.
Yeah.
Is the fallow period is the same amount of time for velvet as it is, or similar amount of time?
A similar amount. It's about 30 days. It's also, we want 30 days at bare minimum in copper to be effective as well. So when it's on your fish and you see 30 days copper is kind of the bare minimum. And the other treatment, like say, is the only other really effective treatment for it is formalin, which we don't want to use formalin. You should use copper. It's safer. You'd have to set up another quarantine tank anywhere. Formalin can literally give you cancer. Just use copper.
Even though copper sulfate works in freshwater, is an ionized copper like cupramine still better?
Copper sulfate is the ionized
copper.
Oh, it is?
Yep.
Because I thought the copper sulfate was what we were using originally.
Is cupramine copper sulfate?
It's
It's a
chelated copper.
Yeah.
Chelated, that's the word I'm looking for.
And are either one of those effective, or does it need to be...
Either one's effective.
Okay.
I said copper sulfate because copper sulfate's the more readily available one.
Cupramine's really available.
Yeah. It is.
Unless you're a C-Chem fanboy like we are.
Yeah. Depending on where you are in the country, the C-Chem cupramine would be the best choice, but that's also not available everywhere. Especially because... So I'm on the podcast listeners group. If you have a weird sick fish and you post it on there, I'll probably respond to you. And I have talked to a couple of you guys on treating things, and I have learned that a lot of your medications that we use here readily are not available to you. So if you live in a region where there's not an LFS that carries C-Chem products.
Yeah, I'm going to loop it back around. You mentioned big box stores carry non-effective medications.
Yep.
If that's all you got, I'm sorry, man.
Yeah.
If you're in the U.S., you can order cupramine from us.
Yes. Yep.
What was the ailment that somebody in Canada reached out?
Oh.
And it was like, oh, you could just treat with this, and it's really easy. And there was nothing and no version of that medication.
Yeah.
I didn't even think Canada can get canamycin.
Yeah, it was canamycin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
we've had people reach out to us and ask us if we can ship it, and it's like... Yeah, no,
so they had I believe it was a bacterial infection, and I talked to them, and they were like, and the only option was canamycin. They didn't have it. And unfortunately, there's not much you can do without too common knowledge that you can do for them. Like, So
we don't know how to help with that situation.
Yeah, that was really unfortunate,
Right.
Yeah. As we're wrapping up Velvet and Ick, I do want to spend some time on like how to spot it early, because I think that's one of the biggest points you need for treating it. Once you see it all over the body, in either case, you're...
It's tough to get past.
Yeah.
Yeah. So looking at where your fish have like the thinnest membranes, like the fins basically is the best spot to look. Ick will look like just a couple of sprinkles of salt. Velvet will look kind of more like a white film at first on the fins. So everybody's going to go look at their fish's fins and be like, does that have just a little bit of white on it? But really, that's all you can see when you're first getting Velvet.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a pectoral fin guy. Like, that's the...
Yeah.
And then dark-colored fish.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Ick is white. So if it's a dark-colored fish, I mean, we keep black mollies in our saltwater quarantine systems because... anything is going to show up on that black body color like it than it will anywhere else.
Yeah. And something I want to touch on with Ick is that I am fully convinced there are two quote-unquote main strains of Ick in the American hobby. Because I've seen two that behave... They're both Ick. They both behave like Ick. But I have seen two... Like, I don't know how to describe it. Two strains that behave semi-differently.
The easy one and the hard one,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, there's one that reacts really strongly to Paragard, and there's one that reacts very strongly to Metronidazole. And the one that reacts really strongly, like, both of those are effective against most strains, but I have noticed that, if I'm remembering my notes correctly, the strain that gets way more speckles is the one that reacts faster to Paragard, and the one that gets fewer spots is the one that reacts stronger to Metro.
That lines up with what I remember,
too.
Yeah,
and it's just like, it's so weird. And so that's something that I think people should keep in mind, is that, like, parasites and viruses and stuff like that, these are things that are highly incentivized to evolve very fast. Mm-hmm. And so keep tabs, take notes, keep track of what's happening, because... Yeah. Who knows, in 15 years, the ick we have now might not exist anymore, and it could be something entirely different. And so, like, if you're the first person who's just like, yeah, this didn't work for me, maybe the hobby needs to know.
Yeah.
True. Very true.
I'm convinced that at some point, things like aquarium salt must have been super effective to treat ick and are not anymore.
That could
right.
be.
Right.
Because I doubt tree tree oil, because it's a newer item, but like there's like a lot of, like, if you look at like aquaculture manuals from the 70s, it's like, yeah, if we just do a dip in salt, all of the ick will die and we'll never deal with it again in an aquaculture situation where water quality is horrible.
Must be nice.
And like that's kind of, as the result, as we get better at fish keeping and dealing with these diseases are going to evolve with us. So
they get better at dealing with us.
Yeah. Keep notes. Notation is important.
I'm almost convinced that the strain of ick that is in aquaculture facilities is different than ours, too, because it still seems to react well to salt treatment.
They're also using tilapia. And I was looking at a paper this morning. And so, like, the standard recommended dose for salt and treating ick is like 5 ppm for PPTs for our uses. Those aquaculture facilities were using like 20 PPT for treating their tilapia, which is not realistic for majority of our freshwater fish. Tilapia are like the exception to everything.
They can swim in anything.
Yeah, they'll be fine.
You said 20 PPT? What is that, like a specific gravity of like 1.015?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
It's like, what can you do for an old beater versus what do you want to do for your sports car?
Yeah. Perspective too, for the specific gravity for the freshwater people. When we do saltwater quarantine, we bring them down to a lower salinity than that to treat their diseases. Yeah. So, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw tilapia swimming in the harbor in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Right.
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
Nature.
Halimeda. No, wait. The Halimeda is an algae.
It is not. Halimeda is an algae. It's
Hexamida.
Hexamida.
Did we do ick to death yet?
Yeah. It's probably the most prevalent parasite in freshwater aquariums because most people don't notice it. It is in... if you buy a fish and it doesn't go through a quarantine procedure with formalin, because our fish go through a quarantine, we use Procure here, which is not a medication I'd recommend people to use at home, but it is a formalin-based medication. It treats it. But other than that, if you're buying a fish anywhere else, it probably has Hexamida.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. In the literature, what is it, like 80% of fish have it?
Yeah, it's
sheesh.
Insane.
I feel like it's something I've dealt with that much from our supplier, but we've gotten it in with hobby bred angelfish before. Yeah,
so we definitely get it in on our supplier as well.
Interesting.
So I think the difference is angelfish show it really well because they're such skinny fish that you can kind of see the... So actually, I should say some of the symptoms to look for. So if you have a fish that you've got say you've got like a school of tetras and you've got that one that's just kind of wasting away, it's probably got this. If you've got like a skinny fish where you're noticing like an angelfish and you're noticing like right on the sides of their forehead, like just above their eye, and that's losing weight or slightly discolored, that's probably this. Essentially it infects their digestive tract, and it's just stealing nutrients like a tapeworm. Luckily it's easy to treat. Metronidazole based food will almost have 100% accuracy as far as treating it, and you don't have to pull the fish out. So it's easy to treat. It's something that you should probably routinely be treating your aquarium for. Like, I don't want to recommend somebody do, especially if you're adding new fish. Like, if you're adding a new fish every couple of months, maybe once a year, feed your tank with like a metronidazole based fish food, and just as like a yearly deworming, like you would like your dog or cat with like a flea and tick medication.
That's a good analogy, I like.
Yeah, so, and you can mix powdered medications like Seachem Metroplex with food easily.
I actually want to touch on something here. This is another one of my like pet peeves with people like diagnosing fish, where, and this is probably the one that drives me up the wall. Anytime someone sees a fish with white stringy poo, they go, it has internal parasites. I'm like, that would be like, if every time someone had diarrhea, your doctor says you have colon cancer. That is a symptom of literally anything happening in the GI tract.
Like feeding a ton of mysis.
Swapping from a pellet food to a frozen food and then back to a pellet food.
Yeah, or like a thousand other things. This is a symptom. This is not a diagnostic feature, period. White stringy poop does not mean internal parasites. It means white stringy poop.
And it probably doesn't mean it for this one as well. Like,
yeah. It's something to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But not something to overreact to.
Yeah.
Like I said, this is a really easy thing to treat for.
Yeah.
Metronidazole and a flake food. I don't know what you would do without if you like you lived in a country where metronidazole was not legal. But it's legal in Canada.
Oh, good.
And legal in most of Europe. So it's...
Yeah,
a pretty safe recommendation. So, yeah.
So this is going to bring me to a sticky point, because I like sticky points.
Because this has all been so easy so far.
Yeah, exactly. So our regular, hardcore, dedicated customers don't need to listen to this episode, right?
Yeah, if they
pretty much
if they never buy fish from anywhere else.
Right. We get asked all the time about doing an episode on quarantining fish. And we have done episodes on how we quarantine our saltwater fish, and we're probably going to do another one of those episodes coming up soon.
I'll be back.
Getting into the detail. So why I'm going to answer this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Why is it that we are so hesitant to do an episode on home quarantining?
I'm going to pop it. I'm not going to answer the question. Yeah. I think you and I had like 3 weeks where we were arguing about whether or not to do an episode on this.
But I think this is one of the few circumstances where both of us were genuinely mad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, we don't agree on everything, and we're just like, sure, different strokes for different folks. Right. I think we were actually pissed at each other.
Yeah. We still might do one someday, but I'm still not there yet.
Yeah.
And the reason we're so hesitant to do this is because it's going to give y'all an excuse to not bug your LFS to do it better. It's going to give y'all an excuse to go to a big box store and say, hey, I'm not going to add an infected fish to my tank, but they have a really good deal on Neon Tetris, and I know how to home quarantine, so I'm going to buy some.
Yeah.
It's not against you for doing that. It's against giving that big box store or your FS a pass on not providing you with good, healthy fish.
Yeah, just imagine if every time you went to buy dishware, you just accepted that they'd all be broken and you'd have to glue them back together. That's what it feels like to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
People should be serving you a good product. Yes, this is a living thing. Yes, we care about it inherently because of its own worth. But you should still expect to be given a healthy pet.
Yeah, like, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had in the store that more or less shake out, like, if you went to a hardware store and they sold you a faulty tool, that's on the store.
Right.
Give me the product that I paid for. Right. You go to a fish store, and the entire hobby just accepts it. You get a sick fish that should have been treated better, and you're... It's your fault for having bought the fish. How is that acceptable?
That's become industry standard.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's not okay.
Yep.
And acceptable to the point where places have no questions asked guarantees because they just assume that a good portion of what they sell is going to die.
Yeah. A hobby that just assumes ick is in every tank.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fair, safe,
yeah,
by the way.
You have to assume.
If you don't buy from a place that quarantines, or you don't quarantine yourself, you probably do have it in your tank.
It's a great point, though. People should know how to treat their fish, but they shouldn't have to treat everyone.
Right, right.
And honestly, as an industry, fish stores are the place in the industry where it would be most cost-effective, most... What's the word I'm looking for? Most...
Efficient, maybe?
Ethical. Like,
yeah.
Safe.
Because it would... Like, that's at the level where quarantine would reduce fish loss the most.
Well, and it would reduce a huge barrier to entry.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
If the whole hobby said, no, it should be up to us hobbyists to quarantine our fish. That means when little Joey wants to go out and buy a fish tank, he has to buy his 10-gallon tank that's going to be his display where he's going to put his fish in, and he has to buy another 10-gallon tank and all of these medications.
Mm-hmm.
That's too much of a barrier.
Yeah. Now little Joey has to save up $300 to get his first fish.
Right.
That's just mean.
That's just fun.
It's sad. And then when he goes online and says, the fish I got was sick, everyone's going to pile on and say, well, why didn't you get it better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What? Dude, that's not fun.
They go online and they're like, yeah, if you just add aquarium salt, it'll be go away.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then it dies, and then he never keeps a fish tank again.
Yep.
And so then, like, I'm going to throw this out here. We went to several conventions in the last year, and everyone's like, how come young people aren't getting in the hobby? Because we've been being dicks to them for 20 years and expecting, being surprised that we set them up to fail, and they failed and just quit.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the core of the debate that Charles and I got into, sometimes in a heated manner, not super heated, but there was some genuine frustration.
Where you dug in your heels,
we both dug in our heels. Had to do with exactly the point we just made, that hobbyists should not have to. And if we do a quarantine episode, we're allowing hobbyists to give retailers a pass. And we shouldn't.
Yeah.
The other side of that coin is, it is unrealistic in the current state of affairs to have the hobby continue and everybody have access to quarantine fish. They don't. They won't.
They should demand it anyway,
I think. They should demand it anyway. I don't know how to find that balance of we should do a quarantine episode so that anybody who doesn't live in West Michigan can get healthy fish, and how to not give the aquarium industry as a whole a pass it does not deserve.
Yeah, I think this is a great behind the scenes, like, look behind the man. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain,
right?
Because, like, we take suggestions for podcast episodes very seriously. Like, we don't just ignore them. Like, you suggested an episode and we haven't done it, It's probably because we've been arguing about it for about 3 months.
This one we've been arguing about for more than 3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe it's we do a quarantine episode under the preface of someone who goes and collects their own fish.
Maybe.
Because you should quarantine those too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we can do it in a vacuum, maybe you won't fight.
Right. Yeah. Oh, no, we'll still fight. But, hey, that'll be kind of the fun.
We can't let the podcast get too boring.
Calder, what's a point we've missed? Did we cover it?
You covered it. Don't use formalin at home.
Right. What about bacterial infections?
So, Canaplex, that's the CCAM medication. It works.
What's the active ingredient? Kanamycin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kanamycin. It's really effective. That's what I would use. Sulfaplex, which is...
Symptoms.
Oh, symptoms. Anything that you don't see... Well, that's... Bacteria is the largest group of organisms. So, like... Right.
White or red and raised.
Yeah.
Is your fish bloated? Is it... All of its scales falling off. Does it have fins? Yes or no?
Yeah. If you see redness anywhere...
Yeah.
That's most likely
a bacterial infection. Yeah. Right. Generally, if like scales are raised, like if you're seeing like dropsy is the big one that we always, at least once a month, somebody comes in the shop and they're like, my fish has dropsy. How do I fix this? And it's not they have dropsy. It's they have a bacterial infection. And things like kanamycin, sulfamexazine, sulfaplex, those work really well for treating something like that. Bacterial infections generally, you don't even need to medicate for most of them. Just clean water will do wonders. So increase your water changes, do a lot more water changes, and your fish will probably be fine.
I like the way you double emphasize clean water and do water changes. Oh, by the way, do water changes.
Yeah.
Right? We started out talking about this, and when you look at this, when you do the Google search on the internet, like what's wrong with my fish, or what disease does my fish have, three quarters of the symptoms they talk about aren't a disease. It's a condition.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the condition is because you have poor water quality.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. So if you're looking at what you think might be a disease, the first thing to look at is your water quality. If you have a betta and you think there's something wrong with it, it's because you don't put a heater in your tank. Or then water quality. But eliminate all of those variables first.
Yep.
And then you reduce the likelihood of it actually being a disease.
Mm-hmm.
Then make sure it's actually a disease. And I think Calder, you did a great job of identifying what those actual symptoms are.
Yeah, the big three are really the ones to watch out for. Everything else, it's probably an issue with water quality and or aggression, or there's some other overlying cause, and now you've got like a bacterial infection or a fungal infection as a secondary infection. And those are easy enough to deal with by just addressing the first thing. And then the fish have good immune systems. They'll be able to fight them off. They are capable of doing that.
Treat fish wounds like you treat your own, right? Yeah. Keep it clean. And if it starts to look a little funky, you might need an antibiotic.
Exactly. Yep.
Yep. Well said. What did we miss? What kind of diseases have some of your fish had out there that we didn't talk about today?
Did we talk about worms at all? Like what you'd treat with praziquantel, that kind of stuff?
Not really. We see it in freshwater fish, but not nearly as often as saltwater fish.
I guess we did have fish come in with anchorworm once.
Yeah.
The hard thing with like internal parasites like that is it's hard to know, like unless your fish are just eating and just keep getting skinnier. Yeah.
And there's more common diseases that are more likely that you can treat with metronidazole. And if you treat with metronidazole, it'll probably kill those worms too. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, praziquantel, or treat a tank with General Cure, which is the API product that's praziquantel, metronidazole. Prazipro is that Hikari that makes Prazipro?
Yeah.
Hikari. The Hikari product that has metronidazole and praziquantel. And both of those would be effective for like an internal parasite issue.
The only other one I can think of that like you'd get asked about a lot is columnaris.
That is so rare.
It is.
Betta people seem to see it a lot or talk about it a lot.
They see it a lot.
Yeah, exactly. That's like you'd see like red stuff coming out, right?
Yeah, it's probably... Treatment would there for columnaris, it'd be clean water, and there's not a whole lot you can do, like, as far as available medications. I mean, any of the anti-ciliate medications should be pretty effective against columnaris. So metronidazole probably is also effective. Metro is a really effective tool just to have. Like, pick up a bottle of powdered metronidazole and keep it in your
room. Nice thing about dry stuff is it lasts.
Right? Yeah. Never use it. Keep it in a drawer somewhere and say one of these weird diseases. It's a good general medication. It's not a cure-all, but if you... Most of the big scary diseases we see are caused by a ciliate that would treat. So,
Anchors Away is a product that I read about for anchorworm. It's the only one that actually works when we had it here. Now, this is a goldfish that had like 19 anchorworms floating all over it. We tried Prozzi and we tried Metro. Absolutely zero effect on it. We tried manual removal, and I could manually remove them, but another one would just grow back. I don't even know what is in Anchors Away.
I don't know.
It worked.
It does. It probably works. Yeah. When I was doing goldfish, I would just treat with copper for anchorworms. Anchorworms are a parasitic copepod. So it's an invert. You can treat it easier with copper. Copper is just like, I don't know what Anchors Away is. Like, its active ingredient is. It could even be like formalin.
Who knows?
Copper safe,
like,
and easy to use.
And everyone listening is going to be like, how do you not know? And it's like, how many times have you seen it? I've seen it once in like 20 years.
Right.
There's a bottle downstairs. We can find out.
Because it's been sitting around
for like 6 years, the last time we ordered goldfish from that one place that we don't order goldfish from anymore.
Did we spend enough time on swim bladder concerns? That's the other. My fish has swim bladder. That's the other one that I'm thinking of that people...
Yes, your fish does have a swim bladder.
Yeah, so... Honestly, often I don't think the problem is the swim bladder itself.
Right.
Often I think the problem is that people are feeding not great foods, and you're getting gas bubbles in their intestinal tract, and that is affecting the fish in a way where their swim bladder cannot compensate for it anymore.
Yeah.
Basically, they need to poop.
Yeah.
Please don't feed your fish peas. Like, any fish peas, don't, like...
Fasting for a few days is way better than a pee.
You can use Daphnia. Daphnia,
especially not bettas.
Yeah,
why are people feeding bettas peas?
That, and I've also seen, there's a very prevalent goldfish person who I won't say their name, but they posted this week that they very clearly have velvet on all of their imported goldfish, and their solution was aquarium salt and grinding up some cloves of garlic and putting that in their aquarium. That will not solve this issue. So, like, garlic is really good at masking medication. It does not kill any disease.
I think it has some antibacterial properties.
Mild. Like, it's not enough. Like,
not where you could just chop it up and chuck it in there.
It's going to solve it.
Yeah, something I want to harp on here is that what Calder's getting at, especially with bettas, is most fish that we keep in tanks are micropredators. That means that the type of, like, quote-unquote fiber they get in their diet is chitin from things like Daphnia or other inverts.
Like bloodworms. Shell material.
Not insect shells.
Yeah, not cellulose, which is plant cell wall. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are herbivorous fish. That is not what we're talking about here.
Right. Fruit flies are another good one, too.
Yeah.
Even for goldfish, probably don't feed them peas. It's probably not going to help them. It's just such a common thing that's pushed around, and there's like no evidence for it. Other than that, they're full of, like, frozen sweet peas are loaded with sugar, so fish will eat them. So yeah.
The original intention, I think, is the fiber to sort of clear out the system, so that if a fish is constipated and their bloat is caused by that, then it'll clear out. And so what you're essentially doing there is, if the stomach is pressing on the swim bladder to the point where it can't function, you're emptying out the stomach and giving the swim bladder a chance. But fasting for a few days is better than that. Yep. And if the swim bladder isn't functioning for some other reason, then those peas are only going to make it worse.
Yeah. And
people get really weird about not feeding fish for a few days. And it's like, they're fine. They don't care.
No, three or four is nothing. Yeah.
Well, if there's some kind of disease that you've seen in one of your tanks, send us some questions on our podcast listener page. We'll listen and call them.
Yeah, everyone who's post diseases like apologizes for it, but that's part of what that page is for. So if you have questions, if you want to get some group opinions, that's the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast listeners group on Facebook.
I'm not going to say I really like seeing the disease questions, and but it's fun to figure out.
Yeah,
and it's also fun to figure out what they are. So.
Yeah.
You're not bugging anybody.
No.
Calder.
Yes.
Thank you for being a guest tonight. I appreciate it. I know you need to drive all the way back to Grand Ledge this evening.
Stupid cat.
Yes, stupid cat. Yeah, Calder's been making like extra trips to Grand Ledge lately for cat issues, but we definitely appreciate you being on the show tonight, and you helped make it better.
Yay.
Yep. Everybody head over to watercolors.shop and see if you can find something that you want to take home tonight. Other than that, you know where to find us on Facebook. You can also email podcast@watercolorsaquariumgallery.com or podcast@watercolors.shop with questions, concerns, or questions you want us to read on air in our next listener's questions episode.
Otherwise, thank you so much for listening. Let's have lots of fun and keep those hands wet.